Care on this day of October 23rd, 2006. Thank you, committee members. I thank you for being here, and I have talked with Senator Carter as well as Senator Cruz person to person, and they are expected to be here. So hopefully they'll be here shortly.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
Can I introduce a guest of mine this morning? And my guest is Craig Johnson. And Craig is a student at Central High School in Independence, Monmouth area. And he is shadowing me this morning. And I'm very honored to have him because one of the things we all talk about is the need to make certain that our young people know and understand the way our government works. And so he's here. He has a whole clipboard full of questions that he wants answered in order to report back to his teacher. When are you reporting back, Craig? Is it tomorrow?
Yeah.
Craig?
Craig.
Okay. Welcome, Craig. We're glad to have you here.
Thank you.
Any other comments, Senator Morissette?
No. Happy to be here.
Thank you. Rick Bacobian, you have some opening remarks first before we...
Sure. Thank you, Chair. Just a couple of housekeeping. If you do have a cell phone with you, please either turn it off or turn it to vibrate so we don't interrupt the proceedings. And just for people here who did not get noticed, the agenda shows us doing LC 175 first. That order has been switched. We will be doing LC 644 on the Oregon State Hospital cremains first, and then at approximately 10 o'clock, we will start the public hearing and work session on LC 175. We have to wait for someone to come down and who's going to kick that one off for us, so that'll be approximately 10 o'clock. That's it. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you. Welcome, Senator Carter. Any opening remarks?
I'm just glad to be back.
I'm glad to have you back.
The surgery all went well, and everything seems good.
So you'll now notice that she's going to be walking a little bit better.
That's right. The bionic woman.
I've had the honor of serving on the Oregon State Hospital Memorial Work Group. And this was a work group that was set up about a year ago, actually during session. Yeah, over a year ago. It's so long ago. Anyway, I've enjoyed serving on it, and I wanted to let the committee members know, I wanted to cite the people that were on this committee. It was Vice Chair Senator Gary George, and then Gwen Barnard from the Church of Scientology Special Affairs Director, Karen Burford from the Cemetery Association of Oregon, Becky Child, who did a lot of work for us, and she's a client advocate, Dave Fiskum from the Providence Health System, Judy Harmon, a former Oregon State Hospital resident, Grace Heckenberg, a former Oregon State Hospital resident, Rick Hiltz from the Cemetery Association of Oregon, Amy Bowman Lowry from the Oregon Funeral Directors Association Board member and legislative chair, Angela Kimball from the Association of Oregon Community Mental Health Programs Policy Analyst, and Maynard Hammard. And I want to thank the work group for we spent a lot of time discussing this. It was a very sensitive issue. We had good input and toured the grounds, and I would now like to call, yes, do we do the work session or informational? Okay. So I'm going to open a work session on LC draft 644, and I'd like to call Maynard Hammer, Jim Monroe, and Eric Hoffman up to testify on this.
Madam Chair, before
yes. Senator Carter.
While they're coming up, I just want to say that I'm appreciative to those of you who've worked to the dignity of mankind on this issue. I think it is so important that every life is recognized, and to be able to bring something before the legislature that is so humane as this is, and as we honor people who've gone on before us, I think it's very, very important that we give people dignity and space in life. So thank you guys for your work.
Thank you, Senator Carter. And I would like to request that, who is going first?
I will, Mayor.
Okay. If Maynard Hammard would give a little bit of a history on why the task group was formed and how far we've come and what has been done. Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the Senate Interim Committee on Children's Health Care, I'm Maynard Hammer. I'm Deputy Superintendent at Oregon State Hospital. I'd like to go through a little bit of chronology here this morning on our cremains, the canisters, and why they've become an issue. We still have about 3,600 unclaimed cremains at the state hospital, and I think the reason why the memorial work group chaired by Senator Moniz Anderson is so important and why it has been ongoing for so long is there are two major links that these cremains represent. One link is they date back to 1913, and that was actually the time that deceased patients were cremated, and many of those patients were old. It predated a lot of current history, of course, in Oregon, so there's a direct link to back almost to the territorial days of Oregon, and it captures the imagination of folks who look at this. The other, of course, more poignant link is these represent 3,600 unclaimed cremains of psychiatric patients. And so they have become a symbol for many of the stigma and the lack of society's acceptance of folks who were inpatients in a psychiatric institution, died, and have been unclaimed. In 1913, the legislature basically set up a central crematorium at Oregon State Hospital. It was at that time named the Oregon State Insane Asylum. At that time, it did change its name to Oregon State Hospital. We became the central crematorium for a lot of different institutions around the state, including our own institution, the Oregon State TB Hospital, Mid-Columbia Hospital, Damish State Hospital, Oregon State Penitentiary, and Fairview Hospital. We actually have a crematorium, we have a building, and we had a mortician on staff. And the cremations took place there for unclaimed patients when they died. Now, that continued up through about 1973, when the last cremains of record that we have. In all, there were 5,132 individuals were assigned a cremation number. We have about 3,600 of those. There is a block of 1,539 who were named as being interred at the Asylum Cemetery, which the Legislative Assembly directed be exhumed and cremated, that we have no record of. It's a complete mystery. We've searched the hospital. I personally have been through tunnels and anterooms, even in places where there's asbestos risk. We can't find any record, nothing. And that has become one of the mysteries and one of the controversies in serving on this work group, is we just don't have a record. But we do have 3,600. These cremains were placed in copper canisters sealed with old-fashioned tin solder. The canisters are pretty small. And up until the year 2000, they were buried in a mausoleum on the state hospital grounds. The water table rose. Those were removed in 2000. The mausoleum flooded. I don't know how many. I wasn't at the hospital at that time. I don't know how many years prior to that the mausoleum had flooded. But the canisters were pulled out, cleaned up, and stored in a building that houses the old crematorium. That's what many of you saw when the hospital began making its let's say, open the doors so the public could see more of what we're about and what we have there. Those are the pictures you may have seen in the press or on TV. Was our room full of canisters in the old crematory building. That building was not satisfactory. Storage of the canisters in that way was not satisfactory. That's why I'm was and am still hopeful that the Memorial Work Group will come up with an acceptable solution, because that's not a good disposition for unclaimed patients. And I'm not a good custodian of cremains. I know nothing about funereal law. I know nothing about the industry. I've received a great deal of help from the Funeral Directors Association and many of the funeral directors themselves. So we really appreciate that, and it has been helpful. What we ended up doing and where these cremains are now, while we're awaiting a final disposition on either on a memorial or a museum and awaiting the process for new state hospital facilities, is these canisters were deteriorating. So we bought, with the help of funeral directors, they told us what the product would be, 3,600 black plastic boxes that are standard for the industry, and we tagged and bagged all of those cremains canisters and put them in those plastic boxes. Will not stop the deterioration. Some of the corrosion was significant. In fact, two of the canisters burst while we were trying to move them off the shelf. But it will slow it down significantly, and the boxes are now tagged and stored in order and are cataloged. We're also trying to build an electronic database of what we have with dates of birth and who the patient was and type of commitment and all those things. That all has to be done by hand because none of these records were kept electronically. As to the legislative concept at hand and why this is important, there are two batteries of laws that prevent us from disclosing identifying patient information. One is our own Oregon Revised Statutes, Chapter 179. There's a large section in 179.505 that talks about identifying information for patients and, to some extent, for prisoners that are incarcerated with the Department of Corrections that prevent us from releasing identifying information without the consent of the patient. Now, probably the bigger hammer, and I say bigger because it has been been interpreted in a variety of ways and has worried a lot of people, is the advent of the Federal Health Insurance Portability and Accountability Act, HIPAA. HIPAA just plain says a patient does not lose the ability, the privacy rights, because they die. So deceased patients still retain their privacy rights under HIPAA. Privacy rights are that without consent or authorization, a covered entity, that is one covered by HIPAA, may not disclose personal protected health information. And that includes names, patient numbers, almost anything that would identify a person to being a patient in our hospital.
Yes, Senator Carter.
Does it not? If the person can't speak for themselves, and the state would have to speak for them, and does HIPAA still preclude you from being able to speak on behalf of the deceased? I don't understand that. Simply because if there are relatives around somewhere, it would appear to me that the state needs to have the right and the privilege of finding those people, and sometimes you have to go outside of traditional means for finding them. Help me here.
Senator Carter, Madam Chair, I fully agree. That's exactly. HIPAA does not precisely cover the issue of unclaimed cremains. However, the way the law reads, our advice from the Department of Justice is that we really can't do that because in doing so, we disclose the identity of a patient that's in the hospital. So what we have to do is if someone calls, and I'll cover this here, it really gets to the heart of this legislative concept. what we have to do if someone calls, we can't confirm or deny whether they have a relative that's among these cremains. So there's a large burden of proof on them, and there's a lot of back and forth, and usually the family member has to produce information proving they're a family member and provide the death certificate. So needless to say, if you're looking for a relative, maybe a great grand relative who you haven't seen or heard of in 80 years, it may take some doing to get that. But as I tell people, the law prevents us from disclosing; it doesn't prevent you from knowing. So that's our basic problem here, is having the ability to work directly with families. And so what happens in those cases is we have had instances where family members were unable to prove, and our hands are pretty well tied. And it's absolutely, at least in our opinion, in the public interest to find a proper resting place for these remains. And above all, if there's family who wants to be reunited with them, to do all we can to make that happen.
Senator Morissette, and then Senator Winters, and then Senator Carter.
Okay. It just seems to me that either a bill by a congressional delegation for an exemption or a waiver would be in order for this unique situation. Have we talked to our congressional delegation, or have we thought about a waiver for this situation?
Senator Morissette, Madam Chair, no, the answer is no. We haven't talked to our congressional delegation, and the way our DOJ, our Department of Justice, analyzes the federal law, there really isn't a waiver. However, there is a state preemption, and we have been advised that the shall language in the present legislative concept allows the state to preempt HIPAA by telling the Department of Human Services that if a family member calls us, we shall disclose the name. People ask me, is there any opposition to that? I don't know, because we have not been able to go out and publish names or do any kind of publication to find out. I'm not aware of any. No one has ever come forward and said, you shall not ever disclose these names. But at this point, no opposition has surfaced. But the shall language in this bill that says we shall disclose the names to a family member would preempt HIPAA and allow us, with some due diligent proof that the person is a family member without going to get death certificates and everything else, respond. We have a case like that back at the hospital right now. It was a request through an email about a great-grandmother, and we have that. And what we will have to do without the benefit of a law such as LC 644 would provide is cause that person to assume a large burden of proof, because we can't confirm or deny unless there's proof that the person has a right to know.
Senator Winters.
Just to follow up a little on the question that was raised by Senator Morissette, that this is an unintended consequence that no one really thought about I'm assuming when HIPAA proposed their regulation, and even though we're trying to find a solution here in Oregon, it still puts the burden of proof on the families. It may be wise for us to ask our congressional delegation to pursue this further. Sometimes, particularly since there's such a disconnect anymore with people and their families, some in various locations, that it could be very costly, for them trying their best to bring some closure or to the dignity to the end of life. So I would like to, Madam Chair, for us to actually, in addition to what we're doing here today, to have some conversation with our congressional delegation.
I think, thank you, Senator Winters, and I concur most heartedly. The Senate the bipartisan, the Senate, has really taken mental health as an extremely important issue to address in a variety of different ways, and we'll talk about those. If not today, we're definitely going to be addressing these issues when session starts. This is definitely one area that we need to pursue. And then Senator Carter?
Madam Chair, I was going to say I'm glad some common sense is being used here, because it appeared to me they shall disclose to the public, Mr. Deputy Superintendent, would take away some of the burden of proof off the family, because I agree with Senator Winters that this could become a costly expense, and so to take some of that off of this would be a way. But doesn't shall disclose give you the kind of levity that you need?
This is Senator Carter, Madam Chair, yes, for family members it does.
Yeah.
That would allow us to, there's always, in the Department of Human Services, one can't always just take a phone call, but we can a lot cleaner without the family jumping over a bunch of hurdles. Now, mm-hmm. if we can assure ourselves reasonably that the person actually is a family member, then yeah, we can disclose under the language in this concept.
Right, Madam Chair.
Yes.
Just a point of personal privilege.
Yes.
Okay. May I introduce my new counterpart in Senate District 18, Ms. Tina Kotak, who will be the new state representative in the northernmost part of my district, and she's sitting in the back.
I think she's here to testify on the next LC draft that we're going to talk about. Yes, Senator Cruz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think all the good intentions of going to our congressional delegation aside, I'm not sure we can wait the 10 years it would take to get something through Congress.
We can make our point, though, a resolution anyway.
I mean, even the simplest, I mean, you know, Senator Carter was saying that it's nice that we've got some logic happening here, and I say it's very rare for this building, and it's even more rare for Washington, D.C., that you can do things in a straight line way. So having a conversation may be valuable, but I'm not sure productive in the time frame we need here. And maybe you're going to get to this later in your testimony. The one thing and something you said just a little bit ago really struck me, that you know a relative currently would have to have death certificate, and I'm thinking, I've got a great uncle that died 80 years ago. There's no way in God's green earth I'd even know where to look for a death certificate. So what you're saying is that this will allow a more streamlined way of getting that information, and that sort of thing will no longer be necessary?
Senator Cruz, Madam Chair, yes, that's my hope. In the case that you're talking about your great uncle, we would, under present case, probably require a court order before we could even disclose.
Okay.
And I'm thinking we can make that a lot quicker and a lot easier on the family, as long as we have, you know, we'd want some evidence that you are related. But the way the bill is structured, it doesn't restrict it to an immediate family member, and we get a lot of requests from folks that are not immediate family members.
A follow-up, Madam Chair?
Yes.
The only other thing, and I realize this is just a draft and will be subject to amendment, but I'm assuming at some point we're going to put some date certains in here. I mean, we don't want to leave this open-ended, obviously, you know, for the next 30 years to allow people to come. I mean, we want a resolution at some point in time, give the families a period of time to make claims, and then deal with the remains that are unclaimed, sort of thing.
Senator Cruz, Madam Chair, that's a good point, and it's a good segue into the second part of what this bill would do. What our hope would be is that at the point where the Memorial Work Group comes to a conclusion on how the cremains should be memorialized, that the bill would enable us to actually publish names on a memorial or otherwise. Other states have done this. I think some of them have kind of flouted HIPAA. The state doesn't play footloose with laws, although HIPAA does not have a right of action, so lawsuits are hard to bring. What you get is a privacy violation, although I'm not an attorney, but I suspect there are ways to bring a lawsuit. But the law says you shall not disclose, so we don't disclose. So this bill would order us to publish a list of names for memorial purposes, and to my way of thinking, that would be the last point at which somebody could come and claim it remains, because after that they would be interred somewhere unless it was an accessible mausoleum and it was left open-ended. And I think what we would do is defer to the judgment of the Legislative Assembly on that. Our major interest here is in reuniting these remains with the family.
Yeah, Madam Chair, I guess I fully support that, but I think at some point in time, and the legislation should address some time frames for these activities.
Thank you. And with the state hospital that we're going to be building in the next few years, we definitely, if what the committee is trying to decide, well, are we going to have this on the site here where the hospital is? We do where it is right now. Are we going to have it maybe be a part of the state hospital wherever it might be located in the future? So I think the date certain needs to maybe be connected with the state hospital's construction, because we have that definitely in the plan, that in building a new facility that they take into account possibly a mausoleum or a memorial. So that might be the way to word it.
Madam Chair, that concludes my testimony. Thank you for your great help on the memorial work group, and thank you and the committee for your interest in this issue.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, while he's doing that,
yes.
My staff has brought the committee some coffee, so you can talk.
Oh, thank you.
But they didn't bring any scones.
Thank you.
You shouldn't have told Ron.
Madam Chair, some of us are grateful for what is, not objecting to what isn't.
Yeah. So. Mr. Romero.
My little eyes just find everything.
I want to thank you, Senator Mona Sanderson, and the senators for allowing me this opportunity to speak to you this morning. Especially want to give a word of greeting to my senator, Senator Winters. Thank you for the birthday postcard.
You're quite welcome.
Does get noticed. My name is Jim Monroe, and I'm a United Methodist pastor and have been in the state of Oregon for approximately 30-some-odd years, some of them more odd than others. I've been sitting in on the OSH Memorial Work Group, also representing as a board member the Lee Mission Cemetery, which has made an offer of a gift of land as necessary to provide for a final resting place should these cremains need a place to be lodged off of state hospital grounds. And we've made that offer and been working with that group. I've also been involved as a pastor with issues directly related to mental health issues and services in Oregon in five different counties, including Multnomah County with a program called David's Harp, which is an outpatient program for chronically mentally ill that's had a tremendous amount of success. And I was in the early 90s also chair of the Burnside Community Council and Baloney Joe's through a rather tempestuous time as we went through a transfer of services and shared a lot of people in common with the Oregon State Hospital. Also been involved in Lane County, Union County, and Malheur County with mental health related issues. But that's not particularly why I'm here speaking to you this morning. I'm here because in 1998 I was hospitalized with acute depression and was fortunate in that hospitalization in that I had adequate health insurance and I could choose the hospital treatment program that I was admitted to. I was even more fortunate in that I came out of that experience, had been depression-free and medication-free for 6 years. But I think the thing I was most fortunate in is that I had supportive family, and I had a supportive circle and network of friends who were willing to stand with me and walk with me through that whole period of time. They call it noonday demons. And having gone through it, I understand why. I cannot imagine having faced that time in my life alone. And yet, I also recognize that there are a number of persons who have and had faced that time alone. They faced that nightmare by themselves, and many of them died by themselves, at least absent a family and any friends, and many of those died at the state hospital. And many of their cremains are in copper canisters, as Maynard indicated, about the size of a Campbell's soup can, and with not as much integrity in terms of structure. You probably know these stories better than I. You've been sitting in these seats and hearing this and reading about it in the news as I've been sharing and reading about it, reading the same things that I've read, sitting through some of the same meetings that I've sat through. You probably also know the tragic reality that in another day and another age, families were often so ashamed of the fact that a family member had mental illness that they just cut off all contact. And you may also be aware that in some of those instances, the person admitting the family member to the state hospital then shared with the rest of the family that that person had actually died of accident or sudden illness. And so surviving family had no knowledge even that their relative's cremains or that their person, loved one, was at the state hospital. Tragically, even further, when the relative who arranged the admission died, then the likelihood of any family member claiming those cremains upon death of the hospitalized patient that died as well.
Yes, Senator Carter.
So you're saying that because something has been in my, you know, making me feel a little sick about this.
Do you mean to tell me that a person could have died in the hospital and family members were not notified?
I'm saying, Senator Carter, Senator Monis Anderson, that is exactly what happened in numerous cases because family members had no knowledge that the person was even in the state hospital. They thought the individual had already died. We have a member sitting with the work group whose grandmother, I believe it was, whose grandmother was in just such a case, and he just found out 3 years ago that she had even been a patient at the state hospital, had died in the state hospital, and unfortunately is in one of the canisters that are unable to be specifically identified. That is my experience of sitting on the committee. I would yield to wiser heads than mine, but my experience of sitting on that committee and listening to the stories is that is not an uncommon story.
See, Madam Chair, I was asking that question because, you know, the title homelessness just became a big issue in the late 90s, 2000, and it just kind of blew my mind that that kind of stuff took place. So my question might seem a little like...
And it was the insane asylum, so...
Yeah. Well, there was a far greater stigma back then. There's much more acceptance. The research and the treatment programs just make mental health issues just something that is... that we can take care of. But we still have that stigma that we need to combat. And this is, I think, one step to do that.
Thank you.
And that's my thank you. And that is exactly my point this morning, is that with the recent publicity and coverage that has been taking place with the state hospital, there are families who are beginning to come forward and putting together the pieces of the puzzle of parts of their family life, many times relatives pursuing those puzzle pieces who never even knew or met the person who's now deceased, but are trying to put together their family histories and stories, trying to restore the cremains to family cemetery plots, trying to do the right thing, trying to heal the fabric of families that they didn't even know were torn, and trying to put it back together. I think this bill would help those families heal those tears in the fabric of their lives in that way. I think it's right that we spend our time looking at how such a thing could have happened and where family structures and where societal structures and where governmental structures go wrong and build that culture of fear and shame and embarrassment. It's an important thing to do because unless we do that, how else do we right the wrongs? Just as it's important to remember that in other instances the state hospital healed and helped and restored and reconciled people to wholeness. I think that that's a mixed story. But this is one piece of the story that we can have direct impact on, and that's why I encourage the passage of this measure. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Good morning. Chair.
Mona Sanderson.
Mona Sanderson. And committee, I'm grateful that I'm here today. My name is Eric Hoffman, and I am a resident and patient of the Oregon State Hospital. And also with these two gentlemen, I agree that we need to have an opportunity for the community to claim the remains of their families. Family is very important. With the remains that we have at the Oregon State Hospital, they are very delicate at this point. I also feel that when and if we release the names to the community to have them have a chance, that we also need to give a time period from that day that they be released to build a memorial for the rest of the remains, a proper place. And on a personal, that proper place shall, I feel, should be on the Oregon State Hospital grounds as of now, not the new place, because the new place has no grounds of the sadness and the pain and confusions that many of these patients' remains have been through. I was very fortunate to sit down at a small meeting and look at some of the pictures of the remains canisters. And some of them are very beautiful because of the unique coloring, but the others are very corroded. And so I'm very supportive of starting this process of getting the names out to the community. And that's what I have to say.
Thank you so much for sharing. And I think it's so important that we actually have a citizen activist, which I would call you, who has real personal ties to the Oregon State Hospital. So thank you for coming. I appreciate that. Is there any further discussion? Yes.
Is there any way, does this bill provide, I am pretty much in his corner, that, and I know the committee has already worked, and I respect that very much, but it just seems as if, even if someone comes along and buy that land, once we've removed the hospital, if I don't know anything because I've been out of touch, but it seemed like some kind of memorializing would take place on the grounds.
We've talked about ceremonies. We've talked, we're still talking about that, but yes, and that will come before the legislature once the committee vets all of what they feel, because there's definitely varying points of view. We had a survey even out amongst the residents at the state hospital and former residents, and it's all across the board of what each individual may want.
Madam Chair, isn't the Lee Cemetery relatively close?
It's right adjacent to it.
Right adjacent to it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, you know, I mean, at some point, you know, financial concerns do come into this. Mm-hmm. And our ability to build new facilities and if indeed we're going to sell the land without encumbrances, I mean, you know, there's a lot of factors that come in here. I've been to the Lee, and it's a beautiful cemetery, and there's more history there than probably any place in the state of Oregon.
Senator, if I could address that just very briefly, to also let you know that not only is the cemetery adjacent to, but a portion of the cemetery was previously Oregon State Hospital grounds. It was deeded over to the cemetery by the Oregon State Hospital around the turn of the century, and I believe it was somewhere in the neighborhood of 6 to 8 acres.
Okay.
And
maybe a relatively simple solution.
Yeah. It's just that the Lee Cemetery is having financial has a concern too regarding its finances and being able to maintain. So I think they were looking more for a, they wouldn't take it over completely.
Madam Chair.
But we these are all issues that we will be talking about down the road. Yeah, Senator Winters.
I just want to ask it because any proposal will require further refinement, you know, at the next legislative session, including, you know, whether the new siding will be on their existing, whether we're going someplace else. But certainly the Lee Cemetery is there, and it is probably one of our older historic cemeteries in the city, and which was a part of the state hospital. And if there, Madam Chair, if you're ready, this one, you need to know, it's hard for me. I certainly support all of this, but as you probably know, I just recently lost my brother, not the state hospital, but anytime we are not able to get closure and dignity, it's hard on the families. I also had a former daughter-in-law who was at the state hospital. And so for me, it's kind of bringing back some memories. But, Madam Chair, I move that we that LC 644 be introduced as a committee bill.
Okay. Senator Winters moves that the legislative concept 644 be introduced as a committee bill. Is there any discussion? Hearing none, those of the opinion that the legislative concept 644 be introduced as a committee bill will answer aye as your name is called, and those opposed, no. The clerk will call the roll.
Senator Curtin?
Aye.
Senator Curtin?
Aye.
Senator Morrison?
Aye.
Senator Winters?
Aye.
Chair Morrison?
Aye. Motion carries. Thank you very much, and we have passed our first committee bill. All right. Okay, I'm going to close the work session on LC 644, and I'm going to... And we are going to recess until 10 o'clock.
Cool.
like to open a work session. Open a public hearing on legislative concept 175. Committee, this is the Healthy Kids Plan that we started. Senator Courtney had stated, let's have a children's health committee and try to get some legislation that we know we can get through next time. So since January, February until now, we have been vetting this Healthy Kids Plan back and forth with the governor's office and with the stakeholders. And it's still a work in progress, because now once we get to start addressing it during session, probably some little... Though there may be a few more tweaks, but this is a good framework to start with. What I'd like to do, the governor's office has put together a PowerPoint that I feel really explains the Healthy Kids Plan very succinctly, and so I would like to ask Aaron Kelly-Seal to please present the PowerPoint to us on Healthy Kids Plans.
Great. Good morning. Thank you, Chair Mona Sanderson, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Aaron Kelly-Seal. I'm the Governor's Health and Human Services Policy Advisor. Appreciate the chance to be with you this morning, and just want to thank you all for the hard work that you've been doing this year in partnership with us and with the state agencies on this issue. Last week, the Governor's Office hosted a series of outreach meetings with stakeholders, ranging from providers, children's advocates, insurance carriers, Medicaid managed care plans, to start engaging them on some of the detail around both what is being proposed as the program, as well as the policy, and some of the detail around implementation. And this was the PowerPoint presentation that we put together for those meetings. Senator Mona Sanderson was kind enough to join us and thought that it might be helpful just to quickly run through it here with you all. And so I will do that. I won't spend too much time on the problem because you have been working on it for such a long time. You know very well that we have a significant number of Oregon children without insurance, half qualify for our existing programs through the Oregon Health Plan. And the other issue beyond just the problem of uninsurance is the problem that kids have getting access to care. Some kids, obviously without insurance, and we'll show a slide in a moment, have even a more difficult time, but even kids with insurance are having trouble getting in to see physicians and getting the basic health care services that they need. This map just shows a basic distribution of where the uninsured kids in Oregon are. And we had some really good discussion. We had some rural participation this last week in our stakeholder meetings. One county commissioner in particular was wanting to make sure that I pointed out in the context of this that although the numbers of uninsured kids are lower when you get out into the more remote rural areas, it's very much the case for them that they have as hard a time with the issue of access as do urban children and parents without insurance. And so wanted to make sure that even though it looks like they may have less of a problem, it's actually the same problem, just looks a little bit different for rural and frontier communities. One of the points that we make as often as we can when we talk about the Healthy Kids Plan is the fact that there are a significant number of parents. About half of the uninsured kids have working parents. So parents are struggling to afford to provide dependent coverage, and this is for a couple of reasons. One, their employer may not offer it, or their employer may offer coverage for dependents, but the contribution that's required of the employee is so much higher, it's difficult for them to afford it. One of the key components of the Healthy Kids Plan is the fact that it's really a plan for all kids, not just kids that have before now been had coverage available to them under the federal programs, those kids in our lowest income families. And it's because half of our problem, if you will, are kids who are in families today who are employed and who are making too much money to qualify for our state plans. The Office of Health Policy and Research has presented to you all, but this just summarizes their findings about why it is that so many of the kids today who are uninsured in the state actually should be in our existing programs. We have, through a variety of policies, created barriers to kids and families enrolling in those programs, whether it's the fact that our application is so complicated, that our re-enrollment period comes up every 6 months and they miss the window, and when you add to that the fact that they're required to be uninsured for 6 months, you end up missing and having a child without insurance for a longer period of time. We also know that there was some confusion about parents, with parents, especially those who lost coverage through the OHP standard program when that program was reduced during the recession in the last couple of years. Again, I don't think I need to spend as much time making the case with this group that's been looking at this for so long, but we have been making the point to everybody that this is a problem not just for health status and for parents, but it's also with kids, and we have some great state and national data about what happens to the health of kids without insurance, but also there are impacts on their ability to learn, and we have some really good state and national data about those impacts as well. And so we've been working hard to engage the education community to support this initiative as much as they support their initiatives for education, because they're all interrelated when you're talking about kids. Parents, we know today, especially because of that data we saw earlier where kids without insurance are being hospitalized more, they're visiting the emergency room more with more acute conditions, are struggling with the financial burdens of having kids without insurance, and also there is this problem of cost shift. Just looking at the panel, who I know are all experts in the area of healthcare, you know about this.
Question.
Yes, Senator Winters.
Erin, do you have any data on how much is being cost shifted when you look at children, and also if you took the uninsured parents, what does that look like?
You know, I think that this is the issue of cost shift is incredibly complicated, as I think everybody knows. We've got good data about the rates of uncompensated care that hospitals are struggling with. I don't know that we've broken that out specifically for kids and parents. I can do a follow-up with the Office of Health Policy and Research and see what they have specific to kids. I don't know how to...
Because you made the statement about when uninsured kids are hospitalized, and so somewhere that data or that information should be inside of somebody's system somewhere, whether it's the hospital system.
Yeah.
Also in the hospital system should be, because as you know, in addition to making certain that children are funded, you know, I have this drumbeat that we have to work on the issue of parents, particularly the working poor. And those individuals who are out there, the parents that show up in the emergency room, which also translates into cost shift. And I'm just kind of wondering what
right.
the universe is.
Well, this statistic is actually a national one from the Families USA study about the hospital costs for uninsured being passed on to private to those of us with insurance. But I have seen from the hospitals themselves some charts that aren't incorporated here about their uncompensated care rates. I can do some follow-up for them on the adult and the kids issue for you.
Madam yes. Chair, you know, as we go forward and prepare for the next legislative session, it would be, I think, well if we could have some of that kind of information available as to what it is costing us, because if we know that it's costing us X million in cost transferring in hospitals through emergency rooms for children and for their parents, then that gives us a better tool to work with when we're having our discussion in the legislative process.
Senator Morissette.
Thank you. In a slide that you didn't show that you kind of went over, cover all uninsured children in Oregon up to age 19. The bill talks about age 21. I was going to raise that question later. I'm a little bit confused.
It should be 19, through 19. Is it?
Yeah, okay. The bill, maybe I'm taking the 21 age out of context in the bill.
What page is it? Do you remember?
Well, page 3.
Page 3.
There's a whole
26.
List of categorical.
926.
Mm. Well, it's 21 is mentioned a number of times. Line 17, line 26. The next page, line 8, line 11.
Well, this, yes, and I think maybe Lori Freeman from Legislative Council could clarify it, but to me, I think this is dealing with foster care.
well, a lot of different categories. But so we're talking about up to age 19 on this.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yes, that's a great segue to just keep moving forward here. Just as this committee started this work early in the year, the governor's office actually started this last fall, building on some lessons learned from some initiatives that both the governor and the legislature have sponsored in the last couple of years. Looking at the data that I just described, we wanted to be sure that whatever program was put together, that it expanded coverage into working families, not just those who currently qualify. We wanted to make sure that we were doing as good a job as we could do to expand, to reach out to those 60,000 plus kids who should be in our existing programs. And we wanted to make sure that access to health care was a key component, not just more health insurance, as we looked at covering all kids as well as improving their health. And the interrelationship between the two. So the governor in his State of the State address more explicitly outlined a vision about covering all kids up to age 19, making sure that what we were providing them with in terms of coverage was comprehensive, including mental health care and dental care. Those are two issues that we hear frequently in our office from parents as well as from a variety of organizations that serve young kids and families are really significant issues for them. We wanted to make sure that we built on existing programs, that we didn't invent new bureaucracy or new state agencies to do this work, because we've got those in place already through DHS and through the Office of Private Health Partnerships. And we wanted to make sure that for families this was simple and seamless. So we were proposing that there would be one card. All kids would have the same card that were in the program, no matter what coverage option they were being paid for by, as well as we wanted to simplify our enrollment process and make sure we retained kids in the plan as much as we could. The Medicaid Advisory Committee, I know you've heard from them too, went around the state and they had some good conversations with families, with providers, with organizations that support children's services about what this could look like in more detail, and they brought recommendations to the governor in May, and I think presented those here to you as well. So this is, in terms of coverage options, the plan design for the Healthy Kids Plan, which is mirrored in the LC draft you all have been working on. Again, I think a credit to your chair, who's been working really closely with us to make sure we're in alignment about this. But we would continue OHP Plus, what we have today effectively, which does not have cost sharing for parents, for all kids up to 200% of the federal poverty level. So that is an expansion of the existing program. Today we cover only up to 185%. We would bump that coverage up to 200%. We actually have federal approval to do that now. We just haven't been able to afford it the last couple sessions. So this would be comprehensive coverage without copays or cost sharing for our lowest income families. We would continue the Family Health Assistance Program, or FEOP, through the group coverage, employer-sponsored coverage that exists today. So the Office of Private Health Partnerships today has two kinds of coverage they offer. One is on the individual side, where folks can enroll without their employer contributing in commercial private market plans. The other is through their employer participation in the subsidy program with FEOP. This would continue to cover kids on the employer-sponsored side through the FEOP coverage so that they would have that continuity of coverage with their parents if their parents are covered in FEOP.
Senator Winters?
I have a question. I'm going over, and I might wait until you get to the form.
Sure.
Or can I ask you?
You can ask the senator anything you'd like.
There's a question on your form number 6, and I'd just like an explanation.
Okay.
Because it talks about partner or spouses.
Okay. Yeah.
And make you afraid by threatening, yelling, or physically hurting you or your children. Can you explain the purpose of it? And
well, I'm not exactly the expert on the form, but I will venture a guess and then do some follow-up with Jeannie Phillips from DHS, who works on the enrollment issues for the department. But if you look at the other handout that I think you have, which looks like this on the front page, Healthy Kids Plan, if you turn to the top of page 2 of that document, you'll notice that there are some exceptions to the uninsurance requirement that the state would be proposing to continue. And one of those exceptions is that the household parent was involved in a domestic violence situation or that the a family member was a victim. And I think that the issue there is really intending to get at how quickly we can make the family eligible for coverage. But again, I'm not an expert on the application itself. I brought it just to show you that at one point we had an 11-page application. With families identifying that as a major barrier, we've been making every effort to get it down to 2 pages.
Follow up.
Jeannie's actually here. I could maybe call her up to have her respond more directly, since I'm not the expert on this.
The intent wasn't really to go into the application as such, but I think to clarify would be very helpful.
Good morning.
It's a work in progress.
It's a work in progress.
I'm Jeannie Phillips from the Division of Medical Assistance Programs for the Department of Health or Human Services here in Oregon. The question actually has been on all of our applications for any type of assistance through the programs, and the purpose is to identify as early as possible any type of abusive situations that may be happening within a household to ensure those individuals are referred for other types of services that they may qualify for that would deal with the dynamic within the family.
And yelling is one of those. I think particularly these members up here who may be screaming a lot. But
I like yelling.
Madam Chairman, Senator Winters, I yell on occasion myself. I think that it's just one of the examples in the possible domestic abuse, and that it would result in some further conversation to see what's going on in the family.
Yeah, you don't want to put something in that's going to discourage someone for answering something truthfully. So I red flagged that because, we have yelling on school grounds, we've got yelling in households, and I'm going yelling. Let's see. Now, remember this, you guys, no yelling on the floor. I'm going to report you.
Yes, Senator Carter.
Jimmy, we did this a long time ago in healthcare. It had to be back in the 80s. At the peak of a lot of the domestic and partner abuse and that kind of stuff and child abuse.
And Madam Chairman and Senator Carter, that's true. That's been a part of the application some time.
Right.
And it is to provide for some early identification of a need for further services.
Absolutely.
We can certainly take a look at the wording.
Why don't you look at
the wording?
Yes, Senator Carter. Follow up.
It has served a purpose in Oregon, ladies and gentlemen. If you will recall, at the peak of many of the years in this state, we've had as many as 35 kids in a year murdered. And yelling and screaming is all a part of that. I really go back to our former Governor Atiyah, who said, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. And if this has been one of the means of us identifying through some standard language that's as old as this language, Madam Chair, very seldom would I go against the chair, but I would very much challenge the two of you on this issue.
No, I think that Senator Winters raised the question. You have provided excellent information for us, and to us it's to protect the children of the state of Oregon, and that's why we want to have a tool that is going to be very useful.
And I don't want to get into a philosophical discussion, particularly one who actually put some of these in statutes in 71. But I also am always mindful of sometimes when we have some things in statute, how they can be misinterpreted in the view of protecting children. And it's for that reason. I also understand that maybe some understand why it's there, but as we bring new staff on board that have not been trained, and you have a word that's out there that can be misconstrued, can also create absolute havoc inside of the system. So that's my reason for saying to make certain that we take a look at, because I don't think that there's any one member on this panel that probably has not yelled.
That is true.
And I don't want to haul you off.
Okay, can we continue with the presentation?
Madam Chair, thank you, Senator Winters. The last piece, the third coverage option, is something new, and it's an option for families who today don't have anything available to them. It's those families over 200%, with family incomes over 200% of the federal poverty level. And the idea here is to provide a private insurance product that includes comprehensive coverage with OHP plus coverage as the model. So it would include dental care, mental health care, coverage for addiction, behavioral health services broadly. This particular piece of the plan would be subsidized based on income, and I'll get into in a moment kind of what we're thinking around those subsidies, but I think that's certainly an issue that this committee will discuss in terms of your own piece of legislation. And we would be looking for health plans across the state to compete, to participate, and offer this new coverage option for those kids in higher income levels. I mentioned the Medicaid Advisory Committee and their discussions across the state with the public about this plan, and a main objective that group had was to really work with families on how much disposable income they had to buy health care for their kids. And so they did the Office of Health Policy and Research did some analysis using an economic analysis that the federal government has put together around cost of living, and they actually tailored it to fit Oregon and looked at things like housing, transportation, childcare, basic needs for families. And for rural communities, the discovery that they made is that it's really not until families have income levels higher than 200% of the existing federal poverty level, that's the point in time at which those families actually have some disposable income on a month-to-month basis. And what we heard from families was that that this economic analysis actually probably overstates the amount of discretionary income they have. We went out into rural communities and they were kind of looking at some of this and saying, well, we think actually the cost for transportation for us is higher than what you included. And it wasn't meant to be an exact science. It was just designed to really show that today we only serve families who are under 200% of federal poverty with any assistance. And this is really looking at, okay, at what level do families actually really have the ability to share responsibility with the state for the coverage for their kids. In urban communities, it's
yes,
really...
Senator Carter.
I'm sorry.
From the area, I think that point should be driven home to us as legislators, especially those of us who live in the valley. Because when you go out in certain communities in rural Oregon, distance in terms of transportation cost is greater. Income categories tend to be lower because they're not in the center of commerce. And I think when you look at the discretionary piece between 200 and 250%, that is a reality in many rural communities. And so that cost should not have to be borne by those people who are already below the poverty line in the first place. So I think using that 200 to 250%, especially in rural areas, would be very, very much a need.
Well, I certainly would be happy to, I think during the legislative session when you all are kind of starting from scratch, if you will, with your counterparts on this discussion, we can definitely beef up this presentation to include in more detail some of the findings the Medicaid Advisory Committee made. And I could actually, and I had meant to grab it, and I apologize for not, I can get a copy of it to Rick, who can recirculate it to all of you, but the questionnaire that the Medicaid Advisory Committee actually put together to use, and they were different for rural and urban communities, that just outlined kind of some of those basic costs, what they estimated them to be, and then led some discussion questions with the public in different communities about that income distribution as well as the cost to live in both urban and rural communities. And I was able personally to go to both, to one rural community for these discussions in one urban community. And in both cases, the folks who were in the room said, actually, you've underestimated what it costs us to live. We think that it actually isn't until we get up to 250, 300% of the federal poverty level that we have disposable income. And in urban Oregon, and this slide looks very similar, except this relates to urban families, the model itself actually showed that it wasn't until families were living up at 250% of the federal poverty level that they had some discretionary income. So really, again, the point that being that these families are struggling not just to provide, to pay for their own contribution. These working families are paying for the contributions that their employers require of them for their own health care, but they're struggling to pay for the health care that their employer may or may not offer to their dependents, which really drives this particular piece of the Healthy Kids Plan.
Madam Chair?
Yes, Senator Cruz.
Just something, because you hear discussions all the time on poverty in the U.S. relative to poverty anywhere else in the world. And so I'm wondering at what point do we determine that it's discretionary income? Does that mean after they paid their cable bill and their cell phone bill and things like that? Or do we have any definition behind what is truly discretionary income? Because my sense is it's probably more than just food and shelter. There are other things included in that we now consider to be basic necessities.
Well, what we do have a definition around and was for the study, and I need to refresh my memory of it, but was what was included in terms of basic needs, and it was not things like cable or things that maybe today many people do associate as part of a basic need. It was really those foundational things like housing, transportation, childcare, food. What does it take for you to subsist and live that were included in the basic cost to live? And then whatever else was left, that would be what someone would need to spend their discretionary income on. And so that included health care. I mean, that's, you know, even though technically I think we do have universal health care today because you get it whether you're able to pay for it or not, we just don't have a system that reimburses fairly for that. The cost for things like cable or anything that really was beyond those basic needs, utilities was included in basic needs. And so for us, I believe that included your electric bill, your gas bill, not necessarily your high-speed internet bill.
Okay. Follow up? Yes. I guess I'm just, and I understand, we probably have a definition here of what basic needs are. I'm just wondering if those who are responding understand our definition or if they're going off their own definition of what they consider basic needs to be. So, I mean, it's just, you know, just trying to figure out where ground zero is here on some of this.
Well, Madam Chair, Senator Cruz, I'd be happy to recirculate for you the sheet that the Medicaid Advisory Committee used to start the discussion. And the Medicaid Advisory Committee defined for the public in these meetings what counted as basic. Okay. And then they were able to say, well, actually, I have these other things that I need to pay for. For some people, one of the issues that came up repeatedly was, I struggle to save money each month because I worry that my car will break down. And this was particularly an issue in rural communities where they don't have access to public transportation like some of individuals do in the urban areas. So they actually were trying to save dollars every month so that if their tire popped or whatever, they had the ability to actually fix it and keep going to work. So I'd be happy to recirculate and have some more discussion about that with you.
And while we're talking about the Medicaid Advisory Committee, I think it's extremely important for this committee to know that they did, they provided the framework for what this bill is made up of. They are the ones that did all the work, really, in getting the framework to where we could really start working with it. And I do want to thank Tina Kotek and Carol Rahm. They were instrumental in this, and they have been responding. Every new draft we come out with, they respond, especially Tina and Carol. And we've incorporated some of their recommendations, and others we feel we need to keep a broader framework and not get too micromanaging on it, but I want the committee to know that we need to thank them very much. All right, proceed.
So this just shows an example, and this is not intended to be exactly what could happen. It's simply what we are basing as an example for discussion, some of the coverage around so that folks can understand what it would actually cost families to participate in the Healthy Kids Plan. If you look at the first, up to 200% of the federal poverty level, I mentioned that half of the children who are uninsured today actually qualify for existing programs. That takes us up to 185. When you take it up to 200% of the federal poverty level, there are about 68,000 kids in Oregon who could qualify for OHP who aren't on it today. So they would be participating. This the third column over and the fourth column are really, again, just examples of what a family of four could look like, what a family of two could look like. That doesn't mean if you have one parent and three kids that you wouldn't qualify. It's just an example. But it shows you the income level, what their annual income is up to that federal poverty level definition. And then it shows the percent that of subsidy to the family. And then the last column is how much the family would be contributing in terms of dollars to the program. So up to 200%, as I mentioned earlier, no cost sharing for families. That's exactly what we have today for families up to 185 in OHP Plus. And then above that, again, the Medicaid Advisory Committee made recommendations to us. We've had lots of discussion with them about a sliding scale of subsidy for families based on income level in terms of contribution by the state and contribution by the family. And so what we are proposing, at least the governor's proposing, is that at between 201-250% of the federal poverty level, there would be an 85% subsidy. And if you use an estimated premium of about $160 per child per month, that translates into about $24 per child for a family that fell within that particular income definition. It goes up from there, and once a family is making has an income of 350% of the federal poverty level or higher, they still could participate in the program, but they would be paying the full cost of the premium at that point. So again, I'm sure that you know, we look forward to lots of discussion with the legislature about what these subsidy levels look like, but I think we feel, based on the conversations with the Medicaid Advisory Committee and the public, like what we're really aiming for is to make sure that this is an affordable coverage option for families, and that's what we're proposing that could look like.
And I think that some of the information that was given to us, many of the families that fall between 250 to 350 are dropping their insurance now. And so that is important information for us to know also. Yes, Senator Winters.
Where it says 350 and up and the income is 700,000 and higher. I mean, 70,000 and higher. Does that mean I could go up to a 250,000 income? That opens the door for anyone?
Yes, those families whose children are uninsured and who have been uninsured for at least 2 months, and I'll talk about that in just a moment, could buy into this plan, but they would be paying for it all on their own. The state would not have any role in supporting it except that we're creating the coverage option for them and their kids that isn't available today.
So question, the means test, the test then is if they've been uninsured for 2 months. The child has been without insurance for 2 months. Is that correct?
I'll get to that in just a minute, but that's what we're proposing to require, at least at the beginning, in terms of an uninsurance requirement.
So if this is announced that we're going to go forward with this, that wouldn't prevent anybody from being to cancel any insurance, keep their children uninsured for a couple of months, and then apply?
One of the things, we looked at this issue, which is often called crowd out, and looked at it pretty closely. The Medicaid Advisory Committee was actually recommending that we eliminate totally the uninsurance requirement for the program. Again, if the policy statement the state is making is that we want every child to have coverage, we want to reduce the barriers to that as much as we possibly can. We looked at New York in particular, which had actually done that. They've actually eliminated their uninsurance requirement, and they've done so in conjunction with a very close monitoring of what that means in terms of the number of people who previously had their children covered through employer-sponsored coverage or not, and looked at this issue of crowd out and what that really meant for their public program. If I'm remembering the data correctly, and it's been a while since I've looked at it, it was a very, very small percentage of impact that having no uninsurance requirement actually imposed on their program. And I'm sorry, Madam Chair.
I think it's important for the committee to to know that we did discuss this before. And in Section 13 of the legislative concept, we have directed the Office for Oregon Health Policy and Research to analyze and evaluate the implementation of this program. And if we start seeing barriers, that there maybe should be more barriers set up to avoid people who are discontinuing their dependent health coverage, their employer-sponsored dependent coverage, and enrolling their program in this program, we need to know that information. So we want to keep the barriers as minimal as possible. And yes, maybe some people will do that, but there is going to be really a good evaluation on how this is being implemented and who is taking advantage of this kind of insurance.
Madam Chair, I'm just wondering, you know, using New York as a comparator, is that to a degree apples and oranges, they're a high reimbursement state, we're low. I'm wondering if there's anything similar to us that we could be looking at rather than a rich state like New York. I mean, you know, there's a lot more federal funds available there, obviously, for the state allocation, simply because they have a higher reimbursement rate than we do, significantly higher.
Madam Chair, Senator Cruz, I think that's something that we can look at more closely. We did, I think, search for other states that had dealt with this issue in terms of our comparison, and what we were focused more on was how high an income level they actually allowed to be eligible, because I think that the issue of crowd out is different for families who are working, especially families who are working at incomes that are higher. And so that was really where we were struggling, was that there are a few states that have gone up to 300% of the federal poverty level, and we can look into more detail. I just need to be reminded of what some of their findings may or may not have been. But New York was a model that we seized on because they had done such a really good evaluation. Just as Chairman Sanderson's pointing out, I think our plan with this program is to include funding for the Office of Health Policy and Research so that we can learn about the impact that the program has both on employer-sponsored coverage as well as on uninsured kids. Now, the interesting thing is, in the stakeholder meetings that we had last week, there are definitely two perspectives on this issue, and there are some people who are pushing back, saying that there really shouldn't be any period of uninsurance. Again, if the goal as a matter of public policy is really to cover every child, that we need to do that. The other issue that was raised that I think we agree is a good one that we want to look into more is the participation, or the possibility of participation by employers in terms of this particular plan, and whether we can do a better job than we've done, at least in our initial proposal, of creating some avenues for that. And so Rocky King at the Office of Private Health Partnerships is looking into how something like that could work as well.
And small businesses, they say this is one of their top priorities, and since so many of them are dropping health care coverage as it is, and then if they are able to buy into this, at least for dependent coverage, this is something that small businesses may like to look at.
Madam Chair, just a point on the six-month uninsurance requirement. I mean, we spent a lot of time on that, and basically it wasn't ever designed to be a barrier. What it was designed for was to keep people from bouncing in and out of the program, and because we were seeing a lot of that, you know, in the Medicaid program at that point in time, that people, because you could get on instantly, actually retroactively, and you pay your premium, and then when you're no longer sick, you quit, and then reapply. And so, I mean, the design behind that was basically to say, if you want this, then you should be part of it. So, I mean, that was...
Madam Chair, Senator Cruz, I think that issue, I think we actually learned through the OHPR study on kids that the six-month uninsurance requirements actually having sort of the reverse impact on the kids side. And I can get some more data from DHS around the number of kids that flow in and out of the program every year. But I would also make the point that I think that we're really talking about kids here and changing the uninsurance requirement for them. And again, if the policy objective is to just make sure sure that all kids in the state have coverage. That's, you know, we can have another discussion about adults and whether they need to be, you know, more responsible and maintain coverage for themselves and be held more accountable through the uninsurance period requirement. But I think for us, based on the Uper study as well as just the public policy objective that the governor really feels strongly about, we believe that reducing that uninsurance requirement is a direction that the state needs to go.
Yes, Senator Carter.
The one thing that I find quite interesting is that 22 years later, we're still talking about health care for kids. And I'm hoping that even this bill, let alone what we can get through the legislature, doesn't find every reason it possibly can to keep the cheaters out. Because when you sanction the cheaters, you basically sanction some of the good people. And so I think that we should find reason to keep our kids healthy. I don't know about the rest of you guys, but I've reached a point in my life where I want all of them healthy so they can go to school. That's what keeps society strong, and I want my Social Security and my retirement, and I can't have it unless healthy kids have jobs. I'm looking out for my, hopefully, another decade.
You can't retire.
And so, you know, we got to find reason to keep kids healthy and going to school and having, you know, stable lives so that they can handle the challenge that is before them, because it's going to be your generation. I have, you know, that's going to reap the benefits of being able to having a healthier society. So, Aaron, no matter what we do, and colleagues, I hope we find reasons to keep kids healthy and not reasons for the cheaters to find means for getting into the system and unlocking. Because you're going to find people who always know how to cheat, and that's why we have jails and justice systems, because people are not fair.
Thank you, Senator Carter.
Press on.
Press on.
This is just a different way of looking at what I just showed you, but focused a little more on state funding responsibility. We do plan as part of the program, if the legislature approves it, to seek federal approval to get match for kids up to 300% of the federal poverty level. Other states have been successful in getting the feds to approve it to that level, and that's our objective as well. This we've just been talking quite a bit about, but starting instead, not just on the issue of keeping kids enrolled, but actually reaching out to kids and families without insurance. We do plan on including in the program funding for targeted outreach efforts to communities. We have some really great lessons, and I know this committee's heard from Ellen Pinney and the Oregon Health Action Campaign.
Committee, let's keep our private conversations down, please. Thank you.
It was her fault.
Yeah, it was her fault.
This is not the Garden of Eden.
And there's no apples on the dice.
So we've had some good discussions in our stakeholder meetings about healthy kids coalitions coming together and really working together differently than they do today to do exactly what Senator Carter was discussing, making sure that we're reaching every family, that our kids are healthy, that they're in school. Schools are going to be a big part of this. And it's about reaching out. It's about providing application assistance, and it's about helping kids stay enrolled in the program so that we can provide health care on a continuous basis. Continual basis for them. Shortening the application, we've had some discussion about our effort there. Again, this is a draft. We'll keep working on to improve it. Extending the enrollment period. The legislature is moving in this direction already. They approved that for CHIP, and we've just not done it yet for our Oregon Health Plan Medicaid eligible kids. So we want to actually implement that throughout the Healthy Kids Plan so that kids have more continual enrollment. We've talked quite a bit about the uninsurance requirement, and we're proposing to eliminate the asset test that we currently have today, which is at $10,000. I mentioned the issue of access being something that's important, and again, focusing on kids' health, not just on health insurance, I think is a really great way that this discussion translates not just to improving the health and economic opportunity for our youth, but it also translates into a lot of, I think all of this actually translates into a lot of good discussion that is going on around adults and what we need to do to focus on health, not just more health insurance and on the healthcare system. But the governor governor has for the last couple of sessions, and you all have supported an effort to expand the number of school-based health centers. We've now grown into 19 counties. We have 47 school-based health centers, and this proposal would include funding to continue that growth so that kids have access on-site in schools. We hear from parents on a very regular basis.
Just a clarification, committee, this is not in the bill. This is the governor's proposal that you're hearing. Okay.
I'm so glad he has vision. It's the one thing that rural communities have always asked for, and that is to have school-based health clinics, because not just students are health centers, but many families in the community. It's an outreach program in many of our schools, and so that's the means by which those people who do have health care in our rural communities have them that can afford them. So I think that's
Madam Chair, Senator Carter, we couldn't agree more. I think the neat thing that the governor's been able to see firsthand is the way that these school-based health centers have really stepped up and expanded their service delivery to include parents, to include younger kids. There are limitations, and we acknowledge those. Many can't afford to be open in the summer. Many can't afford to be open on the weekend, and they're certainly not open 24/7, but they are one way that we can make some inroads into improving access during the school day, which allows parents not to have to take time off work. These centers are also growing down into the elementary school level, whereas before in the state they were really concentrated at the high school level, so that's another exciting feature. Again, dental care has come up for us in a variety of ways through reports. We received this interim, just the struggle communities are having. And so in addition to making sure that whatever coverage we offer for kids includes dental care, we want to also make some effort to expand the preventive dental care options we have for kids. And so the governor's budget will propose expanding the dental sealant program, really getting, again, on-site to kids in schools to help improve their dental health. And then the last piece of the governor's proposal is to make sure that kids are getting the right care at the right time, that they're not showing up in the emergency room when they don't need to. And so having a nurse advice line for parents is a really great and proven way to get parents medical information and help them understand what their child's health needs are and how urgent it is for them to actually go see a medical provider. So this gets into some issues that I know this committee isn't as focused on, but it's, again, the slideshow was intended for some stakeholder meetings just to understand what the governor's budget will be looking at in terms of funding for the proposal, both maximizing the federal resource, efficiently using our state programs, increasing our tobacco tax dollars, and asking families to pay what they can and making sure the plan is affordable for them but based on income. So this is just a summary of everything we've already talked about. I appreciate your time. I think I've probably gone over my intended allotment. But if you'd like to get this PowerPoint presentation electronically, it is on the governor's website, as are the handouts that you have in front of you. And I just open for questions, and thank you for your time.
Senator Weiner.
Just rather quickly, and I don't know if Aaron has it or whether Rick will have it at some point, we'll need a fiscal impact statement. And whether that's been put together yet.
Madam Chair, Senator Winters, we, I think, are pretty far along because the governor's budget is actually really in development as we speak and will be published on December 1st, so that'll probably be the first most formal impact. I don't know whether there's been a fiscal impact done of the bill, but I know that our effort has been to continue to include both legislative fiscal as well, of course, as our own budget analysts as we develop the program.
We are looking at the policy option of this bill and not at the fiscal impact at this point, so we will be passing it out as a committee bill based on the policy.
And at some point, though, we will be looking at the fiscal implications somewhere.
Definitely.
Okay. Just didn't want anyone to think that we're passing policy without talking about
that's right
fiscal impact. That you know, we understand that there is a cost correlation.
Definitely.
Yeah,
yes, Senator Cruz.
Chair, I you really can't talk about one without the other. And I know the governor has proposed a cigarette tax increase, and unfortunately, we tend to do those assuming static models. And the last cigarette tax increase was supposed to solve all sorts of problems and didn't. And generally speaking, I would say the revenue probably will not be what is assumed here. we'll create more black market, and will the people in Oregon, in Portland, will just go to Vancouver to buy their cigarettes. So before our last cigarette tax increase, the people from Vancouver were coming to Portland to buy their cigarettes until we leveled that playing field.
Actually, we are less than the state of Washington, and so I think what the governor proposed will actually put us on a par with the state of Washington.
Madam Chair, Senator Cruz, it's true that forecasts are just that. They're forecasts, and sometimes they're wrong. But there is a lot of effort being made through the Legislative Revenue Office, working with our Department of Revenue, to account for all the different factors about fewer people smoking. The nice thing for all of you here, I think, who care about the health of the state and about the issue of cost containment when it comes to health care, is that increasing the cigarette tax actually is sort of a double hit, if you will. We both generate more revenue to afford programs like this, and we have an impact on the number of people who smoke, especially kids. And so we actually have some great data that's being generated at the national level about the number of lives saved, the number of kids who will not smoke as a result of increasing the tax, and I'd be happy to provide that data to the committee as soon as I have it all in one place.
Just one more point to make, and I don't expect really an answer here, but part of the reality here is that people in my part of the world, our Medicaid population now, even if you're in the program, your ability to have timely access, or actually even if you're in the private sector, your ability to have timely access to providers is somewhat limited. And, and unless we deal with the issue of the fact that we're in healthcare, we're so understaffed across the board in the state, you know, we can create the best thing in the world, but if there aren't providers to see the people, we haven't done anything. I mean, we've done something, but we haven't, you can't have access if you don't to healthcare if you don't have somebody to go see.
And you know, that does allude to the broader picture of healthcare, and we have a number of initiatives, regarding the healthcare workforce, regarding access, and of course we have the Senate Healthcare Access and Affordability Committee, and to me, at least with working with Senator Bates and Senator Westland, they have an initiative they're working on in their commission, and this is all working together. I've been very active in a part of that committee, and so we're not going to run at odds, but we're definitely see the issue, and it's a healthcare is a complicated issue, and but we have to start moving forward. We can't look at all of the barriers and say we can't do it. We've got to be moving forward. Anyway, I'm quite pleased with this. Thank you, Aaron, so very much. And I also want to thank Jeannie Smith and Rocky King and Kelly Harms and Aaron, of course, Lynn Reed and her staff, because they did a lot of review of this legislative concept. We've gotten a lot of feedback, and a lot of work has been put into this. So I want to thank everyone, and it's a step in the right direction. All right. There are three other people. I'd like to ask Tina Kotek and Diane Reschkamp to come up. Oh, actually, Gina and then Karen. Okay.
Good morning, Madam Chair, Madam Vice Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Tina Kotek. I'm the Policy Director at Children First for Oregon. And for those of you who don't know, Children First is a nonprofit independent organization. We're working to create an Oregon where all children thrive, and access to quality, affordable health care is a priority for us. I want to thank you for the opportunity to testify on LC 175 today. And I just want to thank Senator Monis Anderson and Mr. Berkobian for his work on this bill. There has been a lot of work on this bill since the beginning of the year, and I think that's great. I think we are close to a vehicle for the session to start on the Healthy Kids Plan. That's wonderful, so thank you. I want to start off by just reiterating that a priority for Children First is to create affordable access to health care. We know that healthy kids will learn better, and it's very critical to work on the issue that we have 117,000 uninsured children in this state. One of the priorities of making sure that all uninsured children are covered is to really focus on those children 200% or below who are at 185 or below of poverty are currently eligible for the Oregon Health Plan but not on the plan. As you know, that's about 67,000 children. So we're glad to see that that is a key component of this bill, primarily because you are talking about outreach and retention. You're talking about annual enrollment. Those things are going to get us where we want to go in terms of reaching those eligible children and keeping them on the program. So that's very positive. I just want to, I also submitted on behalf of Bob Dupree, staff of the Medicaid Advisory Committee, a letter that's coming around. I'll make reference to it a little later, but as co-chair of the Medicaid Advisory Committee, been intimately involved in the details, and we have done a lot of work, and we're pleased to see that LC-175 is trying to stay true to the recommendations that came out of the committee. However, I do have some concerns that I wanted to specifically address. On page 8 of the draft, section 7, item B, where it talks about package of services comparable to the services covered for folks on Oregon Health Plan Plus. One of the things that the Medicaid Advisory Committee talked about, especially when we talked about the third product, the private health option in the Healthy Kids Plan, was to make sure that the package was what kids are receiving under the Oregon Health Plan Plus. And we're pleased to see that there is reference now in the draft to mental health, vision, and dental services. But Children First for Oregon has great concern about the use of the word comparable here. If the goal is to create a private plan package that mirrors what is offered by Oregon Health Plan Plus, we would like to see that section. We're not quite sure why there's an or there, why it goes from the services covered for essentially Oregon Health Plan Plus or a package of services comparable. We'd like to see that strengthened if you want to leave that in there, maybe make it substantially equivalent. I think the goal is to make sure that all of our children, when they're receiving some kind of public subsidy for a package of care, that it does really mirror what we have worked over the years to provide in Oregon Health Plan Plus. So I just want to raise that concern again. It's also something the Medicaid Advisory Committee has been bringing up.
Can I ask a question?
Yes.
If Ms. Kotek, if you looking at the word comparable, but categorically would include those that are up to 350% of the poverty level or 250% of the poverty level, wouldn't that include those people, all of the kids that are here, but they would have to be in this particular category?
Madam Chair, Senator Carter, I think in that they're talking about categorically needy persons, so children who currently qualify for Oregon Health Plan Plus, I think that's what they're referring to there. So, and then what that package looks like for them, and that the private health option would also, what it says here is the package of benefits would be comparable to the Oregon Health Plan Plus. And so I don't know if it has any reference to income, but I might be reading this wrong. So,
because my concern would be that if this is an expansionary program and you're including all of the kids, why would categorically needy persons be included in this piece if it's expansionistic?
I forgot to thank one person, Lori Freeman, who has probably put more hours than anyone getting this draft out. Do you want to come up to explain that? She's from Legislative Council and has been drafting this bill.
Thank you, Ms. Lori.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Lori Freeman, Deputy Legislative Counsel. The reference to categorically needy just, well, let me back up. In Oregon, we refer to the people who receive Medicaid benefits as various categories of needy. So we have categorically needy children, and we have categorically needy families. We have SSI recipients are considered categorically needy, And so this just refers to the kids under OHP Plus and the package of benefits that they get. So it's saying whatever the package is under this plan has to be comparable to the package that we're providing under OHP Plus to the kids who are currently receiving benefits.
Okay. Is that kind of...
Madam Chair, Senator Carter, I'm not a lawyer, but the word comparable concerns me in the sense that it might not be strong enough. Because if the goal is to be equal, as close as equal, comparable doesn't seem to me to go far enough. And so,
again, we debated this a lot with the stakeholders and with the Family Health Insurance Assistance Program with FEOP. And when you are setting up a contract with the private carriers, we need to have a little bit of freedom there. Our intent, and I think it is our intent, that they that the services be the same. But in order to set up contracts with the carrier or carriers, whoever is going to be providing this, we needed to have this language. Is that correct, lawyer, Ms. Lawyer?
That's what the intent was, to give the Office of Private Health Partnerships the authority to make a determination in individual cases if the package didn't match up OHP Plus exactly, but it covered, you know, a comparable set of packet of benefits that it could be approved.
Senator Carter and then Senator Winters.
Just to follow up, because to go on the other side, do you see any restrictions in the word comparable here that, since we expanded the program in terms of the comparable needy, do you see restrictions here?
I think the use of the word comparable, in the Oregon Health Plan, there's been a lot of talk about actuarial equivalence. Mm-hmm. And actuarial equivalence, not only being hard to say, is really looks to the value of the package.
Okay.
It doesn't actually look at the services that are offered. And so I think the idea with comparable is we don't want to look at, does this cost the same as much as Oregon Health Plan Plus, but is it offering the same range of services?
Senator Winters.
Would it change it any if we use the word the same as? Because we're talking the same services, the same benefits, and I think that's what Tina's trying to get to, so that how does that change if, instead of comparable, that you're talking about same as? All we're doing is expanding the group. The categorical group is already defined. The categorical group services and benefits are defined. And so what we're saying here, that you can't give anything less than what the current group has, nor can you give anything richer than what the current group has. Is that so? Would same as solve the problem?
We have vetted this, and this is according to many input from various stakeholders, is the best language that we can come up with. And Rick, do you?
And I'll defer to Laura, but clarify. One of the issues also came up was the use of your prioritized list with the Medicaid SCHIP program, and having to use language that we did not necessarily connote that a commercial market had to use the prioritized list as well, that they don't always match up.
Okay.
Some of that discussion came up in how the wording was used and how we actually defined the package.
Okay.
So that was one of the dynamics in there as well.
I think, Madam Chair, yes. that if we're on record, you know, as a legislative body, that our intent is that it is similar to, it's same as, and that comparable to us means that you're not going to provide anything less to this group than you act, that you provide to the categorically needy.
Mm-hmm. And thank you for that. I do think the legislative intent is important. Again, not a lawyer, but I would always feel better if it actually said that somewhere in there. But it's good to know that we have on the record that that is the intent, because it does. We won't get the outcomes we're looking for if we provide a lesser package of benefits at those higher incomes, because what we really want to do is make sure children are going for the preventive care, they're getting the full range of care, they're not getting the silo care that you might get with a watered-down private plan. So I think that's the goal, and it's good to know that that is the intent. So if comparable is the word that seems to work, as long as that intends there, we'll keep pushing that, because I think
and
that
committee,
is
cool. I think it's important too that we need the Office of Health Insurance Assistant Program staff to be here to help in when they are implementing these contracts, why they need to be at the table to help us understand the dynamics that are going to go on here.
Right.
Yeah, and follow up, Carter, and then Senator.
I just want to say that with Ms. Freeman being here, I'm feeling very comfortable, Ms. Kotek, that this language and our discussion of the intent is sufficient, because one thing about it, we do not like spending taxpayers' dollars with a lawsuit. And I am sure Children's First would have no problem with filing suit against the state if we were to be misleading in our language here as well as our intent. And so I have to tell you, and many, you and I both have to depend upon the same voter group, that I am sure that that's, I will hear that at the doorstep. So I can say to you, I'm feeling very comfortable with this intent and with Ms. Freeman's input, because I'm sure that she would not have liked to go to Department of Justice to further explain anything else either. So I'm comfortable with that. Thank you.
Okay. Senator Cruz?
Yeah, Madam Chair, I'm just wondering if that's something that's never really been defined. Are we in this legislation defining basic health care?
Well, you always coming up with something.
We have our prioritized list. We have the services that are being offered to our Oregon Health Plan clients, and so we want it to be comparable to that. So in a sense, we have defined it to the... In that sense, because we want something comparable to the services that we are already providing, which is based on a prioritized list for the Oregon Health Plan.
I understand the prioritized list, and I do have my issues with that, is if that's the best bang for the buck that we could be getting. But I'm just wondering. I mean, at some point in time, Madam Chair, you know, the focus on kids is great, but the focus has got to be on all Oregonians. And in my opinion, giving them some financial stake in their health care is critically important to us ever solving this puzzle, or at least slowing down the medical escalator that's killing everybody. And so I'm just wondering if we are setting a bar here that's going to have an impact in other areas we're looking at. That's all. I mean, I'm just looking at that and saying, is this really putting in statute a definition of basic health care?
And I'll just reiterate, we have the prioritized list. We have those services, and so
you're right, Madam Chair. But that's Medicaid. That isn't that isn't universal.
And that's
this is moving universal. So
yeah, and that's I feel why I am more comfortable with the word comparable. And I think the reason we chose the children, because they are the least expensive of all of the people who receive health care in this state. And if we can get a comprehensive package for children and make that fly, because it's going to cost money, if we can get that under control, then the next step is to families. The next step is to universal health care.
Yeah, and I don't want to dominate here, but, you know, but I tend to. Which brings up an interesting point here, is because half of the uninsured kids in the state are eligible. Why aren't they enrolled?
And that,
that begs the whole thing of just focusing on kids and not doing families. We may not get to the outcomes we're after.
As Senator Winters says, we didn't have the money, and we need to look at the revenue stream. And I think we need to move on.
Yes. Madam Chair, Senator Cruz, just one last comment, and I think this goes to the package. And first of all, thank you for not using actuarially equivalent, because I don't think that gets you where you want to go. So comparable is definitely better than that. In terms of the package, though, I think one of the things we have to think about in terms of packages is consistency across from OHP Plus through FEOP as best we can up through the private health option, because implementation-wise, it's going to be a lot easier for providers the closer the packages are. There won't be that much confusion, you know, because you're not going to look at a child and say, what income level are you and what package are you going to get? If we can have that consistency across all three parts of this plan, then it's going to be a lot easier to implement and easier for everybody involved. I just want to drop down to the next line, right under the comparable line, Section 7, Number 2 there. In the letter you have from Bob DePreet from the Medicaid Advisory Committee, and as you heard from Aaron, a lot of discussion with parents about very much a willingness to cost share at higher incomes, but very, very interested in having predictability in that cost sharing and very interested in premiums cost sharing. Children First has great concerns about the references to co-payments or co-insurance. Now, the Medicaid Advisory Committee did say, in addition to premium sharing, some kind of modest co-pays would seem appropriate. But the committee was very clear about not having co-insurance for families under 350% of poverty, that co-insurance would totally negate that predictability issue, having to pay a lot up front before your child could be seen, high deductibles, very difficult. We urge the committee to do, I would just suggest taking out co-payments or co-insurance completely and just say cost sharing and let those details be worked out. The co-insurance issue is very difficult, and it will be very cost prohibitive. We're not going to get where we want to go, which is having families buy the, you know, buy into the plan and stay on the plan if the co-insurance keeps them from accessing the care and or having it actually affordable. So,
Again, we discussed this, and we're spending a little bit too much time, I think, on the details, because this is going to be vetted again. My intent is that we've got a great framework, and the details of this that we will address when we are hearing it in committee when session is on. So,
And Madam Chair, I appreciate the time, and although I do, it is a detail, and I'm trying not to go into too many, but it's pretty, I think, foundational to what we learned in the Medicaid Advisory Committee process of what's going to make this useful for families to actually participate. And the predictability of the cost sharing is absolutely critical. And I think by making reference to coinsurance, you're leaving, it's getting away from trying to honor that issue that the parents have raised. And so, it's a detail, but I think it's a really important detail. So I hope that maybe we consider and just have cost sharing there. The details of that cost sharing are going to have to be worked out. But by putting coinsurance in there, I think you're getting away from the predictability and affordability, which is how we're going to have families participate in the plan. Just two more items on the period of uninsurance. Children First as well as the MAC committee would have preferred no period of uninsurance, but I understand why that's in there. But it would be good, I don't know if you've considered putting in the exceptions that are listed, both in the report and that are listed in Aaron's presentation around Healthy Kids Plan, some of the exceptions. Right now, I believe it says that the department may adopt rules specifying exceptions to the requirement of period of uninsurance. I'm looking at page 2, section 3. Is it possible to actually list some of those exceptions? I know, again, that's a detail, but I think that's important.
And just in response to that, we did take a look at that, and when we start being too specific in legislation regarding those, this is can usually, as long as it's in, the intent is made that in the rulemaking process it will address that, and that means that we will need to be, for those, especially for those like the Medicaid Advisory, need to be at the table when those rules are being vetted there, and rather than taking that and putting it in legislation.
But it,
yes.
During the process of the legislative hearing, you can, so that the intent also is there, is an opportunity then for you to express what those exceptions are, the committee to express what those, because I agree with you, we don't always leave things up to the department to do it through their administrative rules, because sometimes they go outside of the bounds of what our intent is. So and you'll be in this building, so you can assist in making certain that the department expresses what the concepts and your and the intents are. So that is another opportunity for that to occur.
Wonderful. Thank you, Madam Chair, Madam Vice Chair. And just one last comment. I'm just not clear whether the elimination of the asset test is actually covered in the bill. And so that's just a question I had. But and then I will stop. So thank you.
Yeah. No, the asset has not been. Ms. Freeman, would you,
Madam Chair,
talk about that also?
It doesn't explicitly say that there will be no asset test, but it says that the eligibility is based on income. So the inference is that that's the eligibility criteria, and the criteria that's set forth in the bill are what they have to look at. If I may, yes. On the question of the coinsurance, I think the safeguard that's in there is that it has to be based on the family's ability to pay. So whatever criteria the department comes up with, they have to take into account just what Ms. Kotek was talking about, that they need some predictability and they need some caps on the amount of expenses that they would be responsible for.
Thank you. Okay. Donna? Or the Diane.
Thank
yeah,
you.
Yeah, Diane.
I'm here today because Ellen Penny can't be here. She's in Baltimore. She had to fly off to a child covering kids and families meeting, and she really wanted to be here. And so just I received this last night, and just I hope you can all bear with me. I'm going to try to cover some of the points that she's mentioned, and I hope all of you received. Did you all receive this, Madam Chair and Committee? Thank you. And thank you for giving us the opportunity to be here. I'm working currently as an outreach coordinator for the Oregon Health Action.
Yep, please identify
Committee.
Yourself.
Diane Rushkamp. And I'm doing a pilot program in Marion Polk and Lincoln County with the schools right now, working on getting as many children as possible onto the Oregon Health Plan. So that's my role. The LC 175 moves eligibility for publicly supported health coverage to 350% of the federal poverty level, drastically reduces uninsurance waiting requirements, eliminates the assets test for children, and speaks to the need to make health services affordable for families at various income levels and to simplify enrollment processes. OHAC's testimony will focus on five key areas of any successful voluntary plan to provide coverage options for kids based on income, including LC 175. The main categories are outreach, eligibility determination, enrollment, access, and accountability. Under outreach, I'm just going to summarize some of this. Covering kids and families' experience is that effective outreach is about helping families navigate the excessively cumbersome application and confusing enrollment process. Some of the recommendations are to ensure that the language in Section 8, Section 3, Item A, is intended to include those who have challenges with literacy. Number two, if insurance agents continue to receive private market commissions for enrolling kids in the Office of Private Health Partnership Plans, those commissions and fees should be standardized and capped for any and all plans that are certified to sell an Oregon Healthy Kids product. A portion of the fees certified carriers pay to those agents should be applied to agents that facilitate a child's enrollment in OHP. Agent fee schedules should be no different for a successfully enrolled OHP child than a successfully enrolled private market child. And number three, to enhance, encourage the ability to create database linkages and outreach opportunities between and through all possible and relevant human service and education system programs, including but not limited to licensed daycare providers, the food stamp program, free and reduced school lunch, and, of course, medical assistant programs. Under the eligibility and determination part of Ellen's letter, our recommendations is, number one, to eliminate the uninsurance waiting period for all children or eliminate the uninsurance waiting requirement for children and families with income less than 200% of the federal poverty level. Number two, if elimination of the uninsurance waiting requirement is not a possibility, exceptions should be made for any child. And those are the ones who have been enrolled in any of Oregon's publicly supported health programs within the last 6 months, those whose private health coverage has been terminated because of the business closures, and also those who are medically fragile and or the victim of domestic violence.
And Ms. Freeman, I think we addressed that issue, and so I think that the department will be able to provide exceptions for some of these.
Okay, thank you. I'll pass that on to provide. Okay, and number three, OHAC seeks confirmation that the intent of Section 3, Subsection 3, Line 30 on page 2 is to eliminate the assets test for all children. And I know that's been talked about a lot today. And number five, a centralized one-stop eligibility determination location and enrollment assistance function should be a part of the LC-175, as should be one single application for all parts of the program. One toll-free number for applications, one application assistance for information about the plans offered, and to get updates on status of the application would maximize simplicity of application and enrollment. This line should be open on days other than Monday through Friday and times other than 9 to 5. The function described above should be performed by the state and will be greatly enhanced by the community organizations and agents envisioned doing application assistance in Section 8 of 175. On to enrollment. I'm still trying to summarize. I'm sorry, it's long. Next to lack of information that the program exists and misinformation about its opened or closed and for whom status, the complexity of the current OHP application and the reams of attachments it requires are the greatest barriers to enrollment by the eligible uninsured. Part of the application process is selecting a plan. Wise potential enrollees with the luxury of choice of plan want to know which providers are covered by the plans they can choose. While most plans offer these lists of their current enrollees, plan provider lists are often not current. An example of that is enrollees have to call provider after provider to see which ones are accepting new patients and often not readily available for prospective enrollees. Okay, under recommendations, move quickly to develop one application for all children's health programs. Number two, where possible, eligibility determination should rely less on hard copy inclusion of pay stubs and birth certificates, for example, and more on screens the state already has available to verify information provided in the application. For instance, the Department of Motor Vehicles, Employment Division, application for an enrollment in other state programs, and the vital records section. And on to number four, plans should be required to make a list of participating providers easily available to both prospective and current enrollees and provide regular updates as to which of their provider panels are accepting new patients. Under access, in order to succeed, plans must be required to ensure enrollees' access to providers and to services, starting with preventative services. The ability for children to access providers on a timely basis is maximized if providers that are part of a plan's network if managed care is mandatory and or available, are located in places that children frequent, such as school-based health care centers, for example. Providers are open during non-traditional work hours, evenings and weekends, to accommodate the parents who do not have the luxury of missing work days for routine medical care, and providers are compensated adequately for their services. And I'm just going to scan down here. Ellen asks this question. Is the legislature's intent to have health plans for Medicaid-eligible population look and feel like a private market product and be under the jurisdiction of the insurance division? Okay. Recommendations. And I'm just going to summarize them. Number one, eliminate references to coinsurance as an acceptable method of enrollee contributions. That's page 8, line 26. Page 8, section 7, section 3, ensure that this language is also intended to deny the ability of carriers to delay, not just exclude coverage of pre-existing conditions. Authorized Healthy Kids plans should be required to offer access to all covered services at the point of enrollment without regard to health status of the enrollee. Number 3, page 8, line 9, as indicated earlier, giving parents above 300% of the federal poverty level the option to buy into the Healthy Kids authorized plans is a wonderful idea. Similarly, and for the same reasons related to affordability and continuity of coverage, families with incomes over 200% should be able to buy into OHP coverage. And Section 7, subsection 1, option B should be eliminated. All Healthy Kid plans should be required to provide the list of services provided to categorically needy persons. And the last page, under accountability, all health insurance products sold in the state should be held accountable to providing the access, care, and attention that life and health deserve. This means more than ensuring these plans have adequate reserves, the role of Department of Consumer and Business Services in the case of the private market. Accountability is even more important when public dollars are involved. Recommendations. Number 2, in addition to the other components included in Section 13 of the current LC-175 draft, the report should also include the following information: numbers of applications pended, reasons for the pend, percentage of pended applications that get final approval, percentage that get final denial, percentage of pended applications for which a response is never received, and she did put in a little thing here that says OHAC calls these applications the lost all hope applications. If the state continues to use the entire array of agencies it now utilizes to do eligibility determination, answers should be broken down by agency. The next one is the average and median turn around time between receipt of an application and the eligibility determination. And all of the above should be broken out by primary language of the applicant. The final point here is number 3. OHPR should also be asked to report on access within each plan and for OHP children with open cards. The following should be among the questions for which OHPR should compile answers. The first one is, what percentage of young children, elementary school children, and high school children are assigned a primary care provider within their first 6 months? What percent of enrolled children see their own or any other primary care provider within the first 6 months? And what percent of children enrolled in dental care organizations get dental services within the first 6 months and year of their enrollment? Thank you so much. And thank you for having us here.
Thank you, Diane. Senator Morissette.
Well, you're probably going to address this, but was Ellen involved in the draft of this bill?
She did draft this.
No, the letter.
The bill.
I don't know.
She was at some of our hearings.
I think it's an excellent paper that you've given us. And
okay.
I guess my question is, how much of this has been incorporated?
Yes, and some of this has been addressed. Right. Now, it's nice to have this in writing,
yeah,
because especially the Oregon Health private policy and research will take this letter and incorporate their accountability issues, and we will look at them during session to see if any of them need to be implemented.
Great.
But I appreciate both of your comments.
Thank you so much. Mm-hmm. Madam Chair, can I ask a quick question? The one comment that Ellen had about page 8, since Lori's here, page 8, section 7, subsection 3, that talks about what pre-existing condition. Page 8 of the LC. Ellen Penny has an EY. Oh, you know, it doesn't have a page number. It's under the, at least mine didn't. It's page 4, I think.
Okay.
So this is the one about existing conditions, pre-existing conditions. Ellen Penny's eagle eye. I did not catch that. So, Lori, didn't. Is that also?
Again, I think this is something that we can vet with the Family Health Insurance Asset Program Assistance Program to deal with how the contracts are set up with pre-existing conditions. But we definitely wanted to make sure that the private health options had a provision where there could be exceptions made to those who had pre-existing conditions. We just need to vet that.
But
that's why I was glad that it was put in writing, so that we can have a little bit more discussion. Then we're not prepared here because we don't have the right people here to address that.
Thank you.
Yes, Ms. Freeman.
Madam Chair, I want to ask a question. It does ban the plans from having pre-existing condition exclusions. I think Ms. Penny's, what she was saying is that in some cases they'll cover them eventually, but they delay coverage for 6 months or a year.
Right.
And so he was saying that you should have a provision that not only bans pre-existing condition exclusion, but also any delays on coverage for pre-existing conditions.
Good. Thank you. Does that help?
Yes. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much. Yes, Senator Carter.
The only thing I want to say to all of our people who are presenting, we need to have a framework for discussion. And any barriers we can keep down, I hope a hint to the wise is sufficient to get this in as a committee bill today until we can get it to the legislature, is our intent here.
This is not a final product, as you know. All right.
Obviously.
Okay, thank you very much.
Yes.
And I'd like to call Gina Nickel. And Karen DeMarco might as well come on up, too.
Madam Chair.
Yes.
While Ms. Nickel is coming up, I am glad that the President put this committee together, because I had worked during this session with players in the mental health field that I was going to have a committee, a task force, actually, just in case I wasn't able to get a committee, to discuss children's mental health. And I am hoping that our goal will be consistent with the fact that if we were to divide or to devise new words for physical and behavioral health, that it would be on equal footing. Because it is certainly my intent during this next legislative session to bring forth that issue, so that we, since we have parity in our system now, that we respect it to the greatest degree, so we can also give dignity to our children as well in terms of children's mental health. We had gone so far to even have a private sponsor to be able to sponsor our committee work, our task force, had we not had this committee to make sure that children's mental health is a part of what we do in this state as relates to both system and behavior.
Thank you, Senator Carter, and I think it's the intent to make sure that all services, that's why we mentioned several times dental, mental health, when all those covered. Okay, Gina.
Madam Chair, committee members, for the record, my name is Gina Nickel. I'm the director of the Association of Community Mental Health Programs. And we just wanted to go on record with saying that we are in full concurrence with the letter sent to you dated October 3rd by the Medicaid Advisory Committee. And so we just wanted that on record. We did want to point out, though, that we also agree with previous testimony that we're concerned about page 8, section 7, item B, with the word comparable. We would like it strengthened to say identical. That's really the word that we would like, would be more comfortable with that. But you've already talked quite a bit on that subject, so we won't belabor that anymore. Just wanted to get that on record. Thank you for including mental health and dental in there. I just wanted to talk briefly, because I know time is short, about mental health. And we have put together a children's mental health draft plan that I will email to both of you, because we're still working out some of the bugs. But I just wanted to tell you, with the Children's System Change Initiative that we've gone through this past year due to a budget note that you passed, this ties right in. And the insurance coverage for children's mental health is of utmost importance. Just wanted to remind you, as this committee goes forward with this bill and others, that we need to really look at systems of care development, child welfare, mental health, the judicial system. We have got to partner together, and we see that some of it is fragmented, and we're at the same table, but there's still a lot there to be done. Also, mental health coverage for children. There's not a lot of players out there. There's still kids that are on waiting lists, and we don't have adequate resources for that. Which brings me to the last, workforce development. That ties into that. We don't have enough nurses. We don't have enough docs. We don't have enough therapists to cover all that we need to in children's mental health care, so we need to look at those areas too. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Karen?
Hi, Madam Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Karen DeMarco, and I actually came here today as an assignment for a graduate course I'm taking. And at the urging of Rick, decided to go ahead and testify. I touch on this issue from many, many perspectives, both personal and from a work issue. I'm a nurse. I'm also a nursing instructor, and I'm taking a healthcare policy class. I also have a sister who has two children, one of who was born with hypoplastic left heart, which is a heart condition that is often fatal, and she is on SSI. Her other child is uninsured, and she has no regular job, because if she were to work and get a regular job, they would start to take away her benefits to her one child that is insured through SSI and the care that she receives. Last year, and just to speak to Senator Cruz's comment of why don't these people get care, last year her other son was involved in an accident at his school where during PE a child threw a bat and hit him in the face, and he was diagnosed with a fracture of his face, and she was treated so poorly after that she could barely afford to keep up with. He then needed glasses, had to go to a specialist. It was a nightmare for her, and she's still trying to pay that. So also to speak to that, because she feels so put down when she goes to get care for her kids, she doesn't want to go and get the care. They don't get preventive care. She can barely keep on top of it. I got a phone call this last week. Her child had pink eye. Well, the other child got pink eye, and it was kind of like, well, maybe we can do this over the phone with the doctor, because I can't afford to take my kids in. I don't have the time. My car broke down. Right now I'm hiring her to clean my house two times a month, which is what she does for a living now, kind of under the table. She lives in Gresham, but she's willing to drive to the west side of Portland to do this because she wants money in her pocket, and she lives paycheck to paycheck, literally. And part of that goes into a really low self-esteem. The other side that I see from this is I have students that I tutor up at OHSU, and we were recently on Dornbecker Children's Hospital PEDS acute care unit, and kids that come through there getting dental care that they require anesthesia for because there's been no preventive care. Parents just aren't tuned in because they don't have the service and the finances and the wherewithal to get these kids the preventive care they need. And I think if we can start to reach out and teach them that, that, then as time goes on, they'll start to teach us what it is we need to do to be better health served ourselves. Another thing is that a lot of these kids are robbed of being able to participate in sports. As I'm reminded, I had to take my two kids for their sports physical this summer, and a lot of people can't afford to do that for their children. Now, I'm sure there's ways that they can get that taken care of, but that's one thing that you're robbing a lot of kids by denying them this care. They can't even participate in sports to keep themselves healthy. You know, plus the time off of work to make the appointments to get them where they need to go. It's a very, very complex issue. Along with that, where are you going to find the nurses and the doctors to see them all? So I was urged to speak today, and I'm kind of glad that Rick said, why don't you get up here and talk? I was hoping to be out of here an hour ago, but I want to just speak also to this draft. Part of what my sister says, and I've seen it across the board, the application process is just overwhelming for these people, and they finally throw up their hands and give up. Also to speak to the issue about the domestic violence reference, it takes an average of 7 times to ask a person, and maybe then you'll get them to admit it. So I think that's important that that's there. I listened to a survey that was done a year ago asking kids, what was it you most wanted your parents not to do while you were growing up? It was yelling at them. So you know what? I hate to say it, but that word is important, and it is important to our kids and the stress that they go through, which involves their health. So that's pretty much it in a nutshell. Thank you very much.
Thank you very, very much for coming and testifying. Appreciate it.
There is a lot of work, a lot of task forces addressing the whole big complex issue of health care, and this is just a small portion of it, but a very important piece. All righty. Thank you very much. And is there any further discussion?
Madam Chair.
Yes.
I would like to move that.
Okay. All right. So since there's no more public testimony, I'd like to close the public testimony and open a work session on LC 175.
Madam Chair, I move the LC 175 draft proposal as a committee bill.
All right, Senator Carter moves 175 out as a committee bill. All those who are in favor will say aye.
Can we have some discussion?
Yes. Is there? And those who are opposed will say no. Is there any discussion before we take the vote?
Yeah,
Senator Cruz.
This is tough. You know, I've been wrestling with these issues for a decade in this building, and in a lot of different ways, and with not finding necessarily a whole lot of solutions at this point. But I think I've come to realize a few things. One is that we have a tendency to treat Medicaid as the baseline. And to a degree, this does. And I'm not really sure that's what we should be doing. And over the last few months, I've had conversations with quite a few people, including Governor Kitzhaber, who has got some incredibly revolutionary ideas he's floating out there. And, you know, and one of his basic questions is if we had the Medicaid and Medicare dollars that we expend in this state and we had the flexibility to do with them what we chose, could we create a better system? And I think the answer is yes, we could. And then I've had conversations with Senators Bates and Westland. I'm not on that commission, but we have had meetings, and I guess, I mean, you know, I've been a strong advocate for kids my whole time in this building. I was at least partially responsible for getting Healthy Start expanded statewide, and you know, which I think is a wonderful program. I'm in my opinion, Madam Chair, we are not outside of the box enough here to get to a real solution. I really don't think so. Some of the, I think it was 2 weeks ago, my last conversation with Senator Bates and talking about an HRA, HSA sort of model for basic health care. And giving people access to dollars and you know, in some ways that I think eventually, if we can do this right, would help solve some of our access issues, because I think it would make Oregon more attractive to providers than it currently is. You know, the goal here is laudable, and I support the goal. But I personally think that we can't carve out kids as a separate entity without dealing with their parents. And our goal needs to be access for all Oregonians, not just kids. I know that you're on that commission and you say this does mesh. I'm not sure that it does. I'm really not. And part of my reasoning, Madam Chair, is, you know, how much, you know, Medicaid is becoming a broken system at the federal level. It's getting to the point where they're going to cap it at some point in time because they can't continue to write blank checks. Medicare is also similarly broken for a lot of reasons, including the fact that it's not means tested, and that makes that somewhat unaffordable. You know, I would like to support Dr. John and his concept of just let us keep our money and build our own system. Chances of that happening relatively soon are probably minimal, but it's a discussion needs to happen. I'm not going to stand in the way of this being introduced, obviously, but I think we're missing the boat if... I mean, what I'm really hoping is that when we go into session, that this issue, what the commission is doing now, and this rolls into it, is a separate committee, all by itself, and we need to talk to the president about that, that becomes an issue unto itself with you know, all the other human resource issues need to be dealt with, obviously, but... you know, in 2003, we had a work group in the House, and we spent an ungodly amount of time on the issue. But I still think that our main flaw in what we did is we used Medicaid as the template. Okay? We need to get beyond Medicaid as a template, even though there's a hell of a lot of money involved there. I understand that. But it's time for us to develop an Oregon unique system and seek the waivers necessary to make that happen. I think we have a golden opportunity this session because I know Dr. Kitzhaber wants to be involved and on the national level. He carries a lot of weight. He absolutely does. So I think we need to roll some of his concepts, some of the Archimedes Project into this. And move forward from that perspective. But I still think that for a lot of these kids that are uninsured right now, unless we offer something that's understandable and accessible to their parents, we aren't going to see them. And I think that's where Senators Bates and Westland are moving. And so... this, as a piece of a bigger picture, I can support. I would fund it in a different way, obviously, than what's on the table, and that's open to discussion. You know, concept of 2% payroll tax or something like that for this thing. You know, I might actually support something like that.
I was about to say, really?
it depends on how it's structured, and it depends on how it's administered. And one of the things I like about where Senator Bates is going is administration is going to be local, not centralized, and I support that. So I just want to put it on the table that this is a very small piece. And my hope is that this next session, the Senate is going to consider this broader issue as such a high priority that we have a committee that deals with nothing but it. Thank you.
I appreciate what you say, Senator Cruz. Dr. Bates and I have had in numerous conversations. I've gone to all the meetings, but the meeting you went to, the last one. This is a piece that will definitely dovetail on any reform that comes out of the commission. We so want that to happen. We are going to pass health care reform. We are. And I'm so glad that you're on board with that. And this is a small piece. We don't know what we'll be able to get out of the legislature. You're right. It's a small piece, but it's an affordable piece that can happen. Regarding the bigger issue, I would love it if we could deal with the families and everybody. But at this point, we know we can do this small piece. It's just if we can do more, I'm all for it. Senator,
I'm sorry, I was up and I had my student who was shadowing me, and he needed to go home. But I, would like to echo that this is one piece, but certainly we cannot. And Erin's looking at me because she knows I'm on the family piece as well. It is critical that we get to the working family and the uninsured issues. Senator Cruz is correct. We did some work in 03. Some of us took a tremendous beating behind some of the work that I did in 03. But he's also correct that if it's some way that we can actually add on to the concept of Governor Kitzhaber. We do know that part of our constraints in dealing with the health care issues is tied to the federal funding streams. And having to jump through a lot of hoops that, as Oregonians, we would not like to be jumping through. So, I think the concept, if we're able to sell it, is a good concept. But I'm looking forward to all of us actually working together this upcoming legislative session with all these various concepts to see what we cannot do in a very constructive way dealing with both families as well as that. I don't think in when I think of families, I also think of children. So I'm one of these individuals that think in both terms, but also looking at the federal stream and how can we build a health care system that we in Oregon want. I kind of tire, quite honestly, of a system that always we're looking at only to conform with what the federal government wants or what they have in their little bag, which may or may not conform itself to us. And we've spent so much time doing that as legislators. And I recognize that funding is great, but we never have really talked about, in Oregon, what it is when we talk about access and affordability. For us and our families, both the children as well as their parents. So I hear a lot of energy. I hear a lot of concern. I hear a lot of commitment. And it's my hope that in this session coming up that will carry itself forward, that truly what Senator Bates and others are doing and what's being done here, that you can bring it together, and that the Senate President and others will actually, like we did in 03, to sit down and talk about building, coming up with legislation that will for once address some of those issues. And I know that funding is always there, Madam Chair. That's always like veterans said, we had the ability to do children, however, we didn't fund it. And so maybe this time we recognize that the issue is such across the state that we're going to need to be very proactive, as well as one that the good senator raised, that we have to deal with the issue of workforce. And that's another piece of this whole puzzle when we talk about health care in the state of Oregon. It's not just kids. It's not just the uninsured. This whole access issue is there staring us in the face. The issue of your profession retiring, and do we have enough in the pipeline to take care of the citizens? We're here in Salem talking about trying to recruit 150 positions. Not everybody wants to live in the great city up north. And I'm sure that they have their issues as well. And it's an issue across the state that we're going to have to address and deal with. But with that, I will be supporting the children, recognizing that we're going to have a lot of discussion come 2007.
Okay. Senator Morissette?
Well, Dr. Kitzhaber's plan is still basically a non-plan, and whether or not he's able to implement it remains to be seen. I'm not sure that Senator Bates and Westland and Richardson and Representative Richardson and Hanna have addressed the public sector part of the health care problem. I don't think that they've got a plan yet. I mean, a little plan. This is concrete. What we're doing today...
This little plan is worth building.
No, okay. I'm not going to hold my breath on either one of those others. No, seriously, I'm not. I think we need to work for it, but I think this is something that's concrete that we can move on, and if it can be incorporated into something larger, fine, but we have an opportunity now to do some good. Not
great.
Perfect, but good. So I will definitely support.
Further discussion? Okay. Senator Carter had moved that LC 175 be introduced as a committee bill. We've already had the discussion. So will the clerk call the roll?
Senator Carter.
Aye.
Senator Cruz.
Aye.
Senator Morrison.
Aye.
Senator Witt.
Aye.
Senator Watson.
Aye. Motion carries. All right. Is there any other discussion for the good of the committee? This appears to be our last meeting. Yes, Senator Cruz?
Just one comment, Madam Chair, and that is that if term limits passes, our ability to get deep into these issues will very quickly disappear. I'm probably preaching to the choir, but
I want to thank committee members. Yeah. Who? Senator Morrison?
What?
Oh, he's just having a side conversation down
here. Oh, okay. All right.
Yeah.
Thank you, committee, so much. Thank you, stakeholders, and the meeting is adjourned.
Thanks.